pressure changes and ventilation, atmospheric pressure. This varies with altitude. The atmospheric pressure is 760 millimeters of mercury at sea level. The intrapleural pressure, don't forget the pleural space is not really a space because the visceral and the parietal pleura are tightly opposed to each other. So there's really not a space there, but there is a potential space in theory. And the pressure inside this potential space is usually between 751 to 754 millimeters of mercury. And you want the pressure in this space to be less than the atmospheric pressure in order for air to spontaneously enter the pharynx and down into the bronchial, bronchi and bronchial trees. Now, in terms of the work of breathing, the energy required for normal quiet breathing is 3% of the total body expenditure in healthy people. And the energy needed for respiration will be increased by increased airway resistance and decreased pulmonary compliance, loss of pulmonary surfactant. Let's talk about lung volumes and capacities. So we have two types of dead space. We have anatomical dead space and we have physiological dead space. Physiological dead space is equal to anatomical dead space plus the volume of any non-functional alveoli. The anatomical dead space refers to inspired air that fills the upper respiratory tract and lower non-respiratory bronchioles, but never reaches the alveoli for gas exchange. Anatomical dead space accounts for approximately 1/5 or 20% of the inspired air from each breath. The anatomical and physiological dead space are nearly equal in healthy people. So destruction of alveolar walls from respiratory diseases can increase the size of the physiological dead space up to 10 times that of anatomical dead space. Now, lung volumes. Tidal volume is the volume of gas inhaled or exhaled during a normal breath. It's usually between 500 to 600 mL in the adult male. 150 mL remains in the anatomical dead space and is exhaled during the next respiratory cycle. Therefore, 150 mL of the atmospheric gas entering the respiratory system during each inspiration never reaches the alveoli, but is merely moved in and out of the airways. The inspiratory reserve volume, the IRV, that's the amount of gas that can be forcefully inspired after inspiration of the normal tidal volume. And this is usually between 2,000 to 3,000 mLs. The expiratory reserve volume, it's the amount of gas that can be forcefully expired after expiration of the normal tidal volume. And the ERV is usually less than the residual volume. And it's about 1,200 mLs. The residual volume is the gas that remains in the respiratory system after forced expiration. This is usually between 1,000 to 1,200 mLs. And so the combined measurements of the tidal volume, the IRV, the ERV, and the respiratory and the residual volume constitute the maximum volume to which the lungs can be expanded. Now, in terms of pulmonary capacities are the sum of two or more pulmonary volumes. So again, the lung volumes are TV, IRV, ERV, RV. So in terms of pulmonary capacities, the inspiratory capacity is the tidal volume plus the IRV. The FRC, or the functional residual capacity, is the ERV plus the RV. and the FRC is the amount of gas remaining in the lungs at the end of normal expiration. So the FRC is normally about 2300 mLs. Vital capacity is the volume of gas moved on the deepest inspiration and expiration, or the sum of the IRV, TV, and ERV. And this vital capacity is approximately 4600 mLs. Total lung capacity, TLC, is the sum of the IRV, ERV, TV, and RV. And the TLC is about 5800 mLs. Now, in terms of minute volume and minute alveolar ventilation, minute volume is the tidal volume multiplied by the respiratory rate. Minute volume is the amount of gas inhaled or exhaled in 1 minute. Minute alveolar ventilation is the amount of inspired gas that is available for gas exchange during 1 minute. You get this by subtracting the amount of dead space from the tidal volume and multiplying the result by the respiratory rate. So going back to minute volume, an increase in TV and or RR increases minute volume. Next is measurement of gases. Total pressure is the amount of pressure by all gases in any mixture of gases. Partial pressure is the pressure exerted by a single gas. Pressure is measured in millimeters of mercury, or TOR. 1 TOR, T-O-R-R, equals 1 millimeter of mercury. The partial pressure is denoted by the letter P preceding the gas. So for example, the PO2. Atmospheric gases exert a combined partial pressure of 760 millimeters of mercury at sea level. Nitrogen composes 79% with a partial pressure of 597 millimeters of mercury. So the partial pressure of nitrogen is 597 millimeters of mercury. Oxygen is 21% of atmospheric gas with a partial pressure of 159 millimeters of mercury. So the PO2 is 159 millimeters of mercury. Water vapor pressure is another partial pressure that can be measured when gas contacts water. Water molecules convert into a gas, evaporate, and exert water vapor pressure, defined as the pH2O. Now, in terms of the exchange and transport of gases in the body, in a healthy body with a constant metabolism, the relationship between tissue CO2 production and O2 consumption is fixed at 200 mLs each minute. 1 liter of oxygen is inspired each minute. 200 mLs cross the alveoli into the pulmonary capillaries. 800 mLs are exhaled. The exchange of O2 and CO2 results from the passive process of diffusion. Now, don't forget that the PO2 in the blood is higher than that in the peripheral tissues. So oxygen diffuses from the blood into the tissues. Let's talk about oxygen. Oxygen is present in the blood in two forms. The first form is where oxygen is physically dissolved in blood, and we measure that as PaO2, the partial pressure of oxygen in the arteries. Oxygen can also be bound to hemoglobin molecules, and then we measure the extent of that binding through the SaO2, which is the oxygen saturation, which is measured by your pulse oximetry. Recall that oxygen is relatively insoluble in water. Only 3 milliliters of oxygen can be dissolved in 1 liter of blood at the normal alveolar and arterial PO2 of 100 millimeters of mercury. but 197 mls of O2, which is about 98% of the oxygen, are carried in red blood cells, where oxygen is chemically bound to hemoglobin, forming oxyhemoglobin. Hemoglobin can unload carbon dioxide and absorb oxygen 60 times faster than blood plasma can. Now let's talk about the hemoglobin molecules. So the hemoglobin can carry 4 molecules of O2, thus making it fully saturated. Now at a PO2 of between 80 to 100 millimeters of mercury, the hemoglobin is near full saturation. So that's why when you think about it, the you have four sites to bind oxygen in one hemoglobin molecule. After it leaves the alveoli, all four sites are fully bound with oxygen. And then once it courses through the body and returns to the RARV, the oxygen saturation is 75% because the body only used up one of the four oxygen molecules. So the extent to which hemoglobin combines with oxygen increases rapidly when the PO2 is 10 to 60 millimeters of mercury. When the PO2 is 60 millimeters of mercury, about 90% of the total hemoglobin has combined with the O2. The PO2, the partial pressure of oxygen in the blood plasma, which you get in the ABG, is the most important factor determining the extent to which oxygen combines with hemoglobin. Oxyhemoglobin does not contribute to the PO2 of the blood. Now, only the physically dissolved O2 molecules can create gas pressure. And the oxygen uptake by hemoglobin molecules at the alveoli removes the dissolved O2 from the blood plasma and maintains a low PO2, which allows diffusion from the alveoli to continue down its concentration gradient to the blood plasma. Carbon dioxide, the amount of CO2 produced by the body is relatively constant. If the metabolic rate increases, you make more CO2. Metabolic processes affect CO2 production. So metabolism that occurs without oxygen is called anaerobic metabolism. The production of keto acids without insulin is also a phenomena. So carbon dioxide is transported in the blood in three major forms: plasma, which is 8%, blood proteins, 20%, but CO2 is really mostly transported as the bicarbonate ion. So when the bicarbonate ion reaches the alveoli, via the pulmonary capillaries, carbonic anhydrase quickly converts the bicarbonate back into CO2 plus water, and the CO2 diffuses down its concentration gradient and leaves the pulmonary capillaries, diffuses into the alveoli where it is exhaled. Hemoglobin that does not have oxygen bound more readily binds to CO2 than hemoglobin that is bound to O2. Some CO2 that diffuses into RBCs binds to hemoglobin to form carbaminohemoglobin. The remainder reacts with water to form carbonic acid. Bicarbonate, in contrast to CO2, is extremely soluble in water. So venous blood, which is rich in CO2, is returned to the lungs via the venous circulation. And because the blood PCO2 is greater than that in the alveoli, the CO2 from the blood diffuses into the alveoli. From there, it is expired and eliminated from the body. Now recall that hypoxia means inadequate oxygen at the cellular level, whereas hypoxemia refers to a deficiency of oxygen in the arterial blood. Anoxia means a lack of oxygen.